Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. I should say welcome to the second hour of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name's David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. The producers for the show, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Jason Croft is at the controls this morning. Well, I'm sure now in the minds of many people across the country, the state of Illinois has become ground zero for political corruption because of the wide range of charges that have been made against our governor, the one that's perhaps gotten the most attention, the allegation that he was trying to benefit personally from the selection of the person that would take the place in the Senate that had been held by the president-elect, Barack Obama. So this has led a lot of people to ask, well, does in fact the state of Illinois deserve some sort of special place in the history of political wrongdoing? And perhaps also the question, is misconduct, this kind of misconduct, by elected officials any more common today than it has been in the past? Well, that's kind of a big subject to try to wrap our arms around, but we'll try at least to take a few steps into it as we talk this morning about political corruption in the U.S. Particularly one thing that we'll be talking about is that period when the Senate, members of the Senate, were not chosen by popular election. They were chosen by state legislatures. And our guest for the program is Wendy Schiller. She is Associate Professor of Political Science and Public Policy at Brown University and is particularly interested in the workings of the Senate, both in the modern era and also in the 19th century. She's joining us this morning by telephone as we talk. Questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana. We do have a toll-free line, and that one is good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So at any point here, questions, comments certainly are welcome from callers. We only ask that people, when they call in, try to keep their comments and questions brief so we can get in as many callers as possible, but certainly people who are listening are welcome to join the conversation. Again, 333-9455, a toll-free 800-222-9455. Professor Schiller, hello.
Good morning.
Thanks for talking with us.
My pleasure.
I want to say again that I don't know how broadly we can discuss the topic of political corruption. That's an awful big subject if we talk of all of American history. But I guess one is moved to ask this question. Well, really, if you look at what's going on today, particularly if what we're talking about is either people who are trying to benefit personally, financially from their political position, or people who are trying to secure influence by paying someone, do you think that there's really any more of that going on today than there ever has in the past?
No. In fact, I would argue that there's less going on. It's just much more visible and much more publicized than it used to be. I mean, certainly it was the norm in the late 19th century to buy a Senate seat or try to buy a Senate seat. You know, Illinois is not alone in controversy over appointments or even buying Senate seats. In 1899, for example, there were two very publicized cases in Pennsylvania and Montana, literally of Senate candidates buying or trying to bribe state legislators for a Senate seat. In one case in Montana, they actually had the election in the state legislature, and they had hearings on the bribery of that very same election at the same time. And in that case, there were two mining giants, W. Conrad and William Clark, and they essentially, one was Democrat, one was Republican, and essentially they spent $1 million between the two of them, $1 million in 1899 dollars, bribing state legislators, because in those days, if you didn't get a majority on the first ballot, the state legislature as a whole, the House and the Senate, would have to meet every single day at noon and vote on your Senate election until they went out of session. And if they never came to an agreement, then the seat usually remained empty unless the governor appointed somebody. So in Montana's case, they bought the election. The Democrat won. He got to the Senate, and the United States Senate said, wait a minute, we think this was corrupt. It happened that the United States Senate was controlled by the Republican Party. They referred, just as they're discussing today with Roland Burris, they referred the case to the Committee on Privileges and Elections, which came back with a report and said, you're corrupt. We're not going to seat you. So they kicked him out, and he resigned, essentially, and he went back to Montana, and the seat was left vacant. And in 1901, he ran again. He won. He established that it was a clean victory, and he became a United States senator.
So here, I guess I want to make sure that we underscore the fact that as far as Mr. Burris is concerned, no one has has accused him of doing anything wrong. Right. No one have said that he's corrupt. It doesn't have – everyone – seems that everyone has been trying to be very careful in saying, look, this is not about Mr. Burris. It's about Mr. Blagojevich, the governor. So having said all that, though, there have been times in the past when there has been some sort of question about the suitability or the process that was behind someone being named to the Senate, and that has caused the Senate, the U.S. Senate, to say, well, this individual, we got a problem with this individual.
Right, exactly. And this is what's very important. I mean, Roland Burris has been, I actually went to college in Illinois, and when I was in college, he was running for office for the first time or the second time. He's been in Illinois politics for 25 years, and without, as far as I know, any significant taint of any scandal or corruption. But that's where the Democrats in the United States Senate fell down on the job. You know, the governor, for all everybody in Illinois might be very upset with their governor, this was a pretty shrewd move in picking somebody who was relatively immune, or at least at the moment, you know, clean. And so what we have to say to ourselves is, if you're the Democrats in the Senate, you come out strongly, you have to find some precedent. You have to say, well, we have the right to do this, even though this particular man has not been accused of anything, nor has he even been, you know, accused of any kind of impropriety in seeking the seat. The Senate Democrats said, well, we have precedent on our side. We're allowed to do this. This is what the Senate does. So in bringing up the Montana case, what's amazing is that the language is almost identical to Harry Reid's language. We will refer this case to the Committee on the Rules. And so the Senate is, you know, in using this justification, I think the Democrats went way wrong. Because in the case I mentioned, in addition, there's an 1899 Pennsylvania case, there's several of these cases, there was clear corruption. I mean, it was absolutely certain that the person who had been sent to the Senate, you know, had gotten there by illegal means. And in this case, that's not true at all. So I was sort of stunned that the Democrats thought they could bar Roland Burris. I mean, it was unclear to me that they ever had any precedent to bar him. In fact, in the governor's case in Illinois, there's nothing been proven about him yet either.
So I think it's
very important, and it's no accident that Dianne Feinstein, let me just say, from California, the senator from California, is objecting so strenuously to this. It's not just electoral, but she's also possibly running for governor in California in a couple of years, and she wants to preserve the governor's right to appoint a replacement senator.
Yeah. And it looks, at least from everything that I see, it looks as if the Senate probably is going to find some way to do it. I think to accept Mr. Burris into the Senate, and perhaps because there has been so much reaction of the kind that you suggest, that is people saying, well, really, does the Senate have the authority to refuse him? Or they're saying the Senate does not have, or, you know, they're saying, well, the governor may be under a shadow, but he is, after all, still the governor. He has not been found guilty of anything. So that sort of all adds up to the kind of position that you've staked out, where somebody would say, well, you know, maybe the Senate doesn't like it, but whether they like it or not doesn't matter. They can't say no.
Well, that's right. And then let's think about sort of the constitutional grounds, right? The Supreme Court has ruled on a couple of occasions with respect to the House of Representatives, but the general principle is that these chambers do have the right to regulate how they seat people. If there's any electoral controversy at all, they have the right to stall the seating or not accept somebody's credentials. And in this case, there's the Secretary of State of Illinois hasn't signed it, at least as of yet. But look at Minnesota. I mean, if anybody were to come down from Mars and look at these two cases, one would say, well, in Minnesota, it's relatively unclear who won that election. It was so close. There was a recount. There's absentee ballot issues. There's all sorts of electoral issues going on. The Senate, in that case, let's say the Republicans actually control the Senate still, they might have a stronger ground to say, we're not seating Al Franken yet. But with Roland Burris, there's no electoral impropriety. Clearly, the governor of Illinois was taking advantage of his position, which all governors have done, let me just tell you, across history, when there's been a vacant Senate seat. I mean, if you look at the governor of New York, he's trying to fill a seat. And it would be naive to suggest that he wasn't looking for some political advantage in whom he chooses. It's just that apparently the governor took it to a personal extent, which we haven't seen in a very long time, at least not this publicly.
Well, that indeed gets another interesting question, and that is, where is the line that somehow in politics we do expect that people don't always do things for selfless reasons, that they do things, they make decisions, they make appointments, they make deals because they think that it will be to their political advantage. So, and maybe here the fact of them is that the governor is alleged to have trying to make a cash sale, and that it was just too naked, and that's the difference is. But is it that that line there between seeking political advantage and then and actually maybe looking for money you can fold up and put in your pocket, is it clear where that line is?
Well, in this case, you know, the governor threatened to stall, I mean, allegedly threatened to stall a development project that might have benefited the constituents in the area of the project. So, I mean, there were ways in which you could have argued that the governor was shirking his responsibility to the voters of Illinois, in terms of, even if you just don't count the get me a job after I'm out of here, you know, request. I think there's a sense that what's interesting to me about who he was thinking about choosing was that they were mostly qualified people. If you think about the list, let's just say, or the theoretical list, including Jesse Jackson Jr., for example, these were not people that couldn't do the job. These were people who were probably viable to begin with. The question is, who would he choose and how could he benefit from it? So when you think about representation for the state of Illinois, would they have suffered greatly had he chosen, let's say, Jesse Jackson Jr., depending on your politics and your perspective? Probably not, in terms of how well Illinois would have been represented. So I don't think the governor ever intended to appoint somebody who couldn't do the job or didn't have experience. I think he was looking at the sort of pool of eligible candidates and said, well, I'm going to try to leverage this choice. So in terms of shirking his responsibility on filling the Senate seat, you know, personal corruption aside, it's unclear that he would have done damage. You know, it's unclear that he would have hurt the constituents of Illinois by appointing somebody who might have been a contender in any event.
Our guest is Wendy Schiller. She's Associate Professor of Political Science and Public Policy at Brown University. She's particularly interested in the workings of the Senate, both in the modern era and the 19th century. We're talking a little bit about a political corruption in the United States and trying to make some connections between where we've been in the past and where we are now, particularly here in Illinois, with all of the controversy surrounding the governor and his appointment of Roland Burris to fill the seat being vacated, having been vacated. By the president-elect Barack Obama. Questions, certainly welcome. Questions, comments are welcome. 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. We do have a caller here in Effingham, line 4, the toll-free line. Hello.
Thanks for taking my call. A couple of things. In my own opinion, I don't think Rod Blagojevich is any better or worse than any other politician that has ever existed in this country. And the whole situation invites the sort of thing that is happening now. If your guest might elaborate on some of the things that have occurred with Blagojevich and the Congress in Illinois and how his programs and his ideas have been waylaid right along, which seemed to be there from the get-go, which I'm not sure if the Republicans have a majority in the Congress in Illinois or not.
No, the Democrats control both houses and have all of the constitutional offices, so it's essentially an all-Democratic government in the state of Illinois.
Okay, well, then that makes it even more bizarre, because usually they cooperate, but with Blagojevich, that has not happened. And the thing had just become an isolation of the governor. But the thing that I really wanted to ask about, and thanks for the clarification, David, but the case of Ted Stevens, I have heard, I have not saw it documented, that had he been reelected, he would have went right back to the Senate and would not have been taken to court. Is that right?
Well, put it this way, he would have had to undergo, if he had been, you know, formally indicted, and he would have had to face charges, which he may still have had to do. But, you know, just as Illinois remembers Danny Rostenkowski and a lot of other people, I mean, you know, there's sort of a tradition, if you're under indictment, you step aside. Tom DeLay did from Texas also. But I think that Senator Stevens would have returned to the Senate. He would have certainly been an active senator until he was convicted of a crime. And that's sort of, you know, standard prerogative. And there's nothing, you know, very few states have the right of recall. A couple of states do. I believe that Oregon does, but I'll have to double check. But very few states have the right of recall. In other words, they literally cannot get rid of their senator. They can't recall the senator. In the days when state legislatures elected senators, there was a right of recall. it wasn't very frequently used, and it wasn't across every state. But they had a little bit more power to bring the senator home, or at least vote a resolution saying, we don't think you should be our senator anymore. So there isn't a lot voters can do when a senator gets into this kind of trouble. And I think that's very clear. Even with the gubernatorial appointment selection in Illinois and many other states, there's not a lot voters can do there either. One thing I think that might come out of this entire year of politics between New York and between Illinois and Senator Stevens, among others, is across the board, across all states, a law that says when there's a vacancy, there shall be a special election, and that seat will remain vacant. I mean, the thing that surprises me is that there are two senators for every state, typically, two senators. You have one senator on the job all the time. In the very rare cases where there are two vacancies, then there might be a problem. But generally, one senator plus all your House representatives can handle the job for a couple of months. So there seems to me no reason why every state in the union shouldn't adopt a special election and open up the process and see what the voters of every state want to do.
Well, it's becoming clearer for me, but I think it's on a state level in California they have their recall, and they did so with Schwarzenegger.
Right, that's gubernatorial recall. My understanding is they don't have it for senators.
You're speaking on a federal level.
Yes, federal.
All right, well, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
Statement.
To clarify here, and we came across a commentary about this particular situation that was published in the New York Times by a Chicago area writer who has a background in labor law that I thought Tom Gagin, that I thought was kind of interesting and raised this question. He said, well, you know, if you look at the 17th Amendment, the amendment that changed us from having the senators appointed to the senators being elected, it says that, first of all, it says, well, is that now we're going to have the senators elected. And then it says when there is a vacancy, that governors, quote, shall issue writs of elections to fill such vacancies. And he seems to be saying what this says is that there's supposed to be an election, and he seems to be making the argument that the gubernatorial appointment of the replacement is, in fact, unconstitutional.
Well, yeah, I saw that actually. It was a very interesting page full of opinions on this particular issue. And the flaw, I think, there is that it just conflicts with the provision in the Constitution that says states shall regulate the manner and timing of elections for federal office. So, first of all, the amendment says, well, the governor shall issue a writ and there should be a special election. But on the other hand, if the states want to say that special election will happen the next time we have a regular election.
Oh, okay.
Right? So, in essence, for New York State, for example, Governor Patterson will make this appointment, presumably if Senator Clinton gets confirmed to be Secretary of State. But then New York State says, okay, the next time we'll hold our election, special election, is actually going to be 2010, when we already have regularly scheduled elections. So states can come back and say the governor can issue the writ of election that simply says this will happen 2 years from now.
And that's what we're... That's what we're talking about here in the state of Illinois, that in fact that if Mr. Burris became the senator, then he would, or somebody, the next time that position would come up for re-election, then he or whoever would have to run. So he would only be in there for that period of time.
Right, exactly. And what's interesting is that the House of Representatives seat that Rahm Emanuel is vacating, that special election is going to happen much sooner because the seat will remain vacant otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
And we're in the Senate, since you have two senators and you have Dick Durbin, a very powerful senator in the Democratic majority, in some ways, you know, you need the other senator, but it's not urgent. It's not as if there'll be no representation for Illinois. And there were about 45, you know, historians argue about this, 45 or 46 vacancies between about 1870 and 1914 in the United States Senate. Why? Because state legislators couldn't agree, or governors appointed people who were not seated by the U.S. Senate, and so the seat remained vacant. And one state, Delaware, actually went without representation entirely. Neither one of their senators was seated in two different time periods. So there's a lot of history where states simply didn't have two senators at the same time. And particularly for larger states, it matters much less because you have the entire House delegation in another seat. So governors could make the claim that if the federal government wants to mandate that there would be a special election to fill these Senate seats, the federal government would have to pay for it.
Mm-hmm.
And also how that would work is unclear to me, since states regulate the manner of elections constitutionally.
So again, just to go back to your point, and I have another caller we're going to pick up, but you're saying that if states really wanted to create a situation where this kind of problem wouldn't come up, or
right.
people wouldn't raise these kind of questions, then mm-hmm. what they really need to do is to pass a law and says, look, in the event of this vacancy occurring like this, we will at the soonest convenience or whatever language they want to use, essentially as soon as possible, we're going to have a special election to fill that seat.
Right, and then the issue in very bad economic times would be, of course, when would this happen? How much would it cost?
Yeah.
And politically, it's unclear to me that if you're a member of Congress, for example, or the state legislature, which is more important in this case, people would have to vote for it. And the governor, you're not that anxious to do that, because even if you don't personally gain financially from this choice, you certainly have control over who's representing the state and who, who's in your political competitive circle if you're the governor. So it's a power I don't think governors want to relinquish anytime soon, unless they see it as more trouble than it's worth.
And is it now, fill me in on this, as far as the other states are concerned here, we've talked about right now, it's an issue in two places.
Mm-hmm.
Is that the practice everywhere, that if a vacancy like this comes up, that it's the governors always make the appointments, or are there some places where they say, no, what we're going to do is we're going to have a special election?
It depends. Most places, the governor can make the appointment, although there are some states, and I don't know them, all of them offhand, that basically say there should be a special election, as soon as possible. But again, very few states have put that in writing, for the simple reason that there never seems to be an urgency because there's another sitting senator. Some states, interestingly enough, like Wyoming, have a policy, and I think Nebraska too, I have to double check, is that the governor must appoint somebody of the same party as the person who held the seat. So there are more of those kinds of restrictions floating around the United States than there used to be in terms of governors' flexibility in appointing senators. So some states put restrictions and say, listen, just because you're a Democrat and the person who's leaving is a Republican, you can't replace that person with a Democrat. So that might also become a bigger trend. Because if you think about it, the voters put in a senator from a certain party, and when you replace that senator, unless there's been a long time change, your assumption would be voters would probably want somebody from the same party of the person you're replacing. Just as in New York, people are saying, oh, appoint a woman to replace a woman, the same idea might hold. So that's something that's become more of a trend across states, to put some restrictions on governor's appointments. But for the most part, and as you see in Colorado, it was no big deal, right? The governor of Colorado just announced who he was going to appoint to fill Ken Salazar's seat, and nobody blinked. So everything's working very smoothly in Colorado to fill the seat. So it depends, I think, on the state and the amount of political machinations, mm-hmm. but, political brouhaha
yeah.
and political stakes. I mean, right now you've got, Blagojevich fighting for his political and his life in some ways, right, his criminal or civil life. And in New York, you have a governor who's facing re-election in 2010 if he chooses to run. So he's got very serious political considerations to deal with, too, in this choice.
Our guest, again, in this hour, Focus 580, Wendy Schiller, Associate Professor of Political Science and Public Policy at Brown University, very much interested in the workings of the Congress, particularly the Senate, both in the modern era and the 19th century. And questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. And we do have someone here who's been patient over in Indiana. We'll go and talk with them on line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Is Brown in Providence?
Yes.
Okay. This thing that's happening now is the first time I can remember in probably decades that I didn't have an answer to somebody about something. And I'm wondering, from the Midwest newscasters, particularly out of WBBM in Chicago, are talking about we're trading on fresh ground and everybody's afraid to make the first move. And to me, I sort of see it as a metaphor for people walking on a trampoline. We got to get everybody in the same motion for things to work. And throwing in, must have been an awfully intelligent thing, if he did it for that reason, this is a cagey boy. And everything, it just sort of went crazy in D.C., and I can't understand why and go through with it, then sort of clean it up afterwards. After he's been tried and things like that, so there would be no problems. And everybody knows Burgess is clean as you can get. So it just seems foggy to me. Can you put your fingers on it in some way for me?
You mean why did the Democrats in D.C. react the way they did?
Yeah, that one. And is it true that we've never been down this path before with a state having a governor in the situation that Illinois has? That since there's no precedents or any you know, important ones, you know, outside of district courts, you know, maybe up high, a little higher have made decisions. I was just wondering about that. If you could put some light on that, would be.
I think in the modern era, if you're talking about after 1914, with the direct election of senators, there hasn't
something
been...
Something in the you know, memory of people be listening.
Right, right. There hasn't really been, you know, there have been House cases that have been contested, but no, there hasn't really been anything this dramatic or this difficult. And I think the Senate Democrats wanted to push this issue as far away from the president as they could get it. I think they were worried that any conversation, anything to do with this case, would bring up any influence, as we saw that Senator Obama or President-elect Obama and his staff had tried to, you know, sort of call the governor and say, well, you know, we don't want to influence you, but we like Valerie Jarrett. I mean, these are things they didn't want to come out. And I think they were a little overzealous in running away from that. I think it was a miscalculation on Harry Reid's part to be so firm and so adamant and say, we will not accept anybody this man appoints, because they didn't have the power to do that. And I think in their effort to protect the president, what turns out to happen is this week the president-elect says, you know what, I like Roland Burris, he's okay, I trust him, you can appoint him. And so now they're doing a backpedaling. And so I think that this was a political miscalculation. And even that goes so far to say about the governor and the case in Illinois itself, you know, the prosecutor intervened to stop what he believed would be a corrupt act. But on the other hand, by not letting it go through, it's unclear now what the governor actually did. When we know what he maybe tried to do or offered to do, but it's unclear that he did anything, right? He didn't appoint anybody. He didn't get any money for the deal that we know of. So it looks like there was some miscalculation across the board here. And I think to say that the governor of Illinois is trying to be shrewd here, it's true. I think he's trying to get this thing done and get this man appointed. Who knows what the behind-the-scenes calculations in his mind are about this, but I think that it was a miscalculation on the part of the Democrats. And what happened to the Democrats was that they realized, the Senate Democrats, was that by being so adamant about this and saying, we will not take anybody the governor of Illinois appoints, they opened themselves up to a special election call. In other words, okay, well, if you won't take anybody, let's do a special election in Illinois in 3 months. You're having one for the House seat, let's just do one for the Senate as well. Well, the problem for the Senate Democrats is that a Republican can get elected. Right? If you have an open statewide election and you don't preserve the power of this Democratic governor to appoint their replacement or the lieutenant governor, then you open yourself up to real competition and possibly losing the seat. So the Democrats, I think, went too far and then realized that the only real logical extension of their argument was to put themselves in a position of maybe losing the seat. So I think there were some miscalculations there. I don't think you're wrong to think that it's foggy. I think they didn't think it through.
Yeah, well, a good reaction was okay then. Well, thanks a lot. It's very clear.
All right. Well, thank you for the call. Let's go on here. We'll talk next with someone in Urbana and line two. Hello.
Hello. This doesn't pertain directly to the impeachment process, but do you have any thoughts on the process of selecting gubernatorial candidates? Because take our last election. We had Topinka versus Blagojevich, and I voted for Topinka, although it was really a vote for against Blagojevich. And I'm just wondering, do you have any thoughts on the dysfunctionality possibilities of electing the gubernatorial candidate?
Well, in terms of what, suggesting alternatives? You mean how do people get, what kind of experience you might want to require in somebody who's going to be governor?
Well, yeah, is there too much patronage going on or something? When you, I mean, you take the presidential candidates. Two or three elections ago, I voted for Nader, and I really thought he'd be the best candidate. But he wasn't permitted to take part in the debates, and that put him at a distinct disadvantage. So I think there's too much
what you're pointing out is a really important structural bias in our political system, and it is essentially the way our electoral system is set up. Essentially, state legislatures, except for some, and Illinois used to be this way, but they aren't any longer, I'm pretty positive about that, is that they used to be multi-member districts. In other words, you could elect more than one person for a geographic district. We've gotten rid of that now, so you only elect one person for one geographic district. And what that does is that leads people to really want a binary choice. I want a Republican or a Democrat. And the two major parties, essentially, as you just suggested, do everything they can to keep third-party candidates out of competition. And because there's two major parties, if you're a third-party candidate and you do happen to win in a three-way or four-way race, let's say, you get to the legislature, there's nowhere for you to go. If you look at Lieberman in the U.S. Senate or Bernie Sanders from Vermont, who's an independent, or even in the House, they have to go caucus with one major party or the other. So not only electorally are we sort of biased towards two parties, once you get into the legislature, you're also forced to hook up with one or the other major party. So the fact that we don't have multi-member districts, if you had three people that could go to the Illinois Senate from one district or the House, and you had three people, you could elect an independent, a Green Party, a Republican, a Democrat, there'd be a lot more choice. But because you can only send one, and that person has to win a plurality, more votes than anybody else, then that favors the existing party structure, which is two parties. And that's the biggest problem, I think, in the electoral system in general in the United States. It limits who can run. It limits what they can say when they run, because they've really got to affiliate with these major existing parties, or they can't make it through the system. They can't raise money. They can't get on the ballot. They can't get through the primary system. So, and state electoral laws are controlled by state legislatures, which are controlled by the major parties.
That tells me a lot. Do you have an equally insightful view on how we can change it? We certainly can't petition our representatives for change.
No, the only way it will change, literally, is to elect more people who have an I after their name. In other words, elect more people who run as independents. And that's the only way it will change, because if you get more people in there that are not 100% affiliated with one party or the other, then when they're in the legislature, they'll be more open to reforming electoral laws and making it easier for third, fourth, fifth parties to get on the ballot. So I think, you know, it's really going to have to be a slow process, but you've seen in American politics, we have had change. We've had the progressive movement, which certainly opened up for the very important third party at the turn of the century, and it really resulted in direct elections of senators and many other sort of liberal or reform-minded initiatives. So it can happen. It just takes 100 years usually for it to happen, but that's the only way I see it happening. I don't see it happening necessarily from Ralph Nader on the top down. I see it happening much more at the local level, because if you think about it, state legislatures, they're the ones that uphold state electoral laws. And if you want to change your state electoral laws, you've got to change your state legislatures.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. We'll go on to Kankakee next, line number four. Hello.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. This is kind of one of the side comments that was made earlier about Ted Stevens. I believe that Ted Stevens was found guilty, was he not? In his trial in Washington.
Yeah, that's right. He was. I'm sorry. He was, but it's on appeal. So I meant until the case is fully resolved.
You know,
right.
He can appeal all over the place, but if he was found guilty, and would he have been able to go back onto the Senate floor after having been found guilty of a felony?
That's a really good question. Technically, the Senate could have barred him. There's no question about it. You're supposed to. You're basically, when you're convicted and you're out on appeal, you're appealing something, the party will take away your committee chairmanship, the party will take away all your institutional power, but the party, the Senate, if you've been duly elected by your state, it's a political question as to whether the Senate can actually take the step of not seating you. So they would get themselves into this entire situation they have with Roland Burles. They would have to do a petition that goes to the Committee on the Rules, which would have to decide whether they would have seated Ted Stevens or not. But they would have stripped him. He would have been in the minority anyway, but he would have been stripped, for example, of his ranking position on the committees. So that's as far as they would have gone until his appeal was finally decided, even though he was convicted. But they would have been a big political fight, because my guess is, I mean, the Republican minority leader, Mitch McConnell, he said this guy should go. He should resign. He's done. We don't really want him in our party. But it gets to be a constitutional issue because then the Congress is not seating somebody who was allowed to run for and win a Senate seat. So they were duly elected by their state, and then the Senate says, well, we're not going to seat you because you're convicted. So it would have been a question. I don't think it would have been automatic. I think he would have challenged it, Senator Stevens. Had he actually won his election, he would have challenged
it. I'm sure he would have, yeah.
Right. So, and I think it would have had gone to the Committee on the Rules, and they would have held hearings, and they would have come back with a vote that said, we're not going to seat you, we're kicking you out, essentially, and it would have been a majority party vote. And then the Democrats would have kicked him out. So in the end, I don't think he would have served. But there's still, I don't know how to put this, but until somebody's actually convicted and all appeals are exhausted, Washington is slow to move frequently. Certainly slow to move. We go back to the Rostenkowski case or even the Tom DeLay case. I mean, Tom DeLay was essentially pushed out the door, and he hasn't been convicted. So in Texas, his trial's still going on. So, you know, sometimes they're willing to push you out the door if you're a political liability, but other times they feel they have to go through the motions because this could happen to the Democrats and not the Republicans. And if it was a closer majority, for example, you wouldn't want to be in the position of making it automatic because then you'd lose an important vote.
Certainly. Okay, thank you very much.
Thanks. And as I recall, and I suppose someone would say this was a matter of spin, or it was on the part of Senator Stevens, who was trying to make the most solid position for himself. But his argument of his own situation was, as long as I have appeals yet to be made, then I haven't been found guilty of anything. And I think then some other people said, well, no, Senator, that isn't exactly true, but at least that was what he was saying.
Right, he was saying, right, exactly, and he would have continued to say that. Yeah. He would have gone to work every day and gone to his office and said, okay, you kick me out the door. You kick me out the door. And then any time anything would have happened to a Democrat, any hint of corruption, any hint of scandal, then the Republicans, even though Mitch McConnell, as I said, didn't really want to keep Stevens around, he would have made a case for that. He would have said, listen, you kicked our guy out. You know, we're going to make moves to try to kick your guy out. So I think that there would have been, they would have found a way to do this, but I don't think it would have been quick, and I don't think it would have been abrupt. And I think what you're seeing now from the way that Harry Reid and Dick Durbin have been reacting to the Burris case is anything they do resolving controversy or corruption from now on will be much slower, much more private, and much more methodical, because I think they're beginning to really worry about setting precedents as the majority party that might come back to haunt them should they ever become the minority party again.
Our guest, let me just again quickly introduce, for those who might have just joined us, our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Wendy Schiller. She is Associate Professor of Political Science and Public Policy at Brown University and is interested in the workings of the Senate, both in the modern era and the 19th century. And we're trying to talk a little bit about some of the questions that have been raised about politics coming out of the situation here we have in the state of Illinois. Among the things that she's interested in is what was going on in the Senate before 1914, in the time when state legislatures picked the members of the U.S. Senate. And in fact, back at the beginning of the program, she talked about a couple of cases where clearly someone tried to buy a seat in the Senate. And perhaps the move towards a popular election was an effort to try to get politics, that kind of politics, or that kind of influence buying out of the process. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers to call. Next up, we'll talk with someone in Champaign, and this caller is in on line three. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
This whole fiasco with Burris reminds me of a couple of things that are somewhat ominous. One is the famous witticism by Will Rogers about how he doesn't belong to any organized political party. He's a Democrat. And this whole business with, and also reminds me, too, of the, you know, in 1992, the Democratic Party came into power with Clinton and a majority in the Senate and the House, and they promptly self-destructed. The 2 years later with the Contract America, that was, you know, so much for that. But it just strikes me as very ominous and foreboding that none of these people in power in the Democratic Party in the Senate bothered to actually read the statutes involved and carefully consider their position before they opened their mouth, whereas the day that Burris was appointed, ex-Governor Jim Thompson was interviewed by NPR, And he very calmly pointed out that, well, the Secretary of State cannot refuse to sign the appointment by Blagojevich because his function is a ministerial function. He has no say in the matter whatsoever, and the Senate cannot refuse to seat Burris unless he fails to meet some very narrow criteria like citizenship, state residency, age, so on and so forth. And this whole fiasco is just—it seems like a circle of fire, firing square. There, I got it out. Would you comment on that, please? Thank you.
Well, there's two things I want to do. One is just bring you back a little bit in time because history repeats itself. Just to tell you a quick story, in 1891 in Florida, there was a governor, Governor Fleming, and there was a guy named Wilkinson Call. He was a senator, and he'd been in Senate for two terms already. And they led different factions in Florida, right? Florida was a Democratic state, but it had all sorts of factions. And Fleming was on one side, and Call was on the other. And through a long, protracted election, Call finally emerged the winner. There wasn't a quorum in one of the houses, so it was a technicality, but Fleming said, "I'm not going to sign your appointment. And in fact, I'm going to actually ask the Secretary of State not to sign your appointment." So he refused to give validity to the appointment. That case actually had to go to the Supreme Court of Florida, which promptly ruled that the governor was wrong and that he had to sign a certificate, and he did. And Wilkinson Call was seated, and the U.S. Senate accepted that appointment. Even though Call was a Democrat, the Senate was controlled by Republicans in that Congress, he was still forced by the legal process to go through with it. Even though he didn't want to appoint, he had another guy who was loyal to him, he wanted to put his man in, and he didn't succeed. So it's not the case, you know, if you look back in history, it's literally as if you're watching history repeat itself with these technical explanations for why people aren't being appointed and why certificates aren't being signed. So my guess is that the Illinois Supreme Court, if it goes there, will say you have to sign this appointment. There's no reason, legal reason for you to refuse to sign the certificate. The second thing about the Democrats, well, you know, again, history repeats itself. I think here's the problem with this big majority that they've constructed in the Senate. You know, in the House, they didn't pick up as many seats as they thought they would. So Nancy Pelosi's got a bigger margin for sure. But it wasn't quite as striking, obviously, as the Senate's big pickups. And the problem for Harry Reid is that these senators, all that were elected, are from very different areas in very different parts of the country. And in terms of leadership, there really isn't a core ideology that they all share. Even though they all call themselves Democrats, there isn't really a core that anybody's established yet with this new Democratic majority. So the pressure's on for Harry Reid to be the single spokesperson in the Senate for the Democrats. And as you have rightly pointed out, the worst possible thing was to come out so hard line on an issue that was tangential at best to what the Democrats want to do. So it is the nature of the Democratic Party to have more chaos. It is the nature of the Democratic Party to have more disagreement. What the Democrats had learned in 2006, which they seem to have forgotten, at least temporarily right now, is you don't put your disagreements on the table. You don't show them in public. You don't lead the party into a direction where they have to backtrack. You know, you stay low and you stay cohesive and you stay in agreement. And I think in Harry Reid's sort of adrenaline rush, being majority leader really for a real majority now, this is a real working majority, I think that he overstepped his bounds. He made a political mistake. And the only thing the Democrats can hope for is that having made this very public mistake, he'll learn and he'll be more circumspect, as you suggest, and he'll be more thorough and not promise things he can't deliver, because the cardinal sin of a political leader in any institution, any legislative body, is to promise something you cannot deliver. Look at Nancy Pelosi and the bankruptcy and the bailout bill, the first vote. They lost that vote, and that was a stain on her leadership. So this is something that the leader himself, Harry Reid, has to take responsibility for and has to learn. And certainly, if you're a Democrat, you hope that he learns the lesson sooner rather than later. If you've noticed, President-elect Obama has inserted himself not only in this Burris case, but in other sort of not as public ways, and saying, "Listen, you know, Reagan got great support from his party when he came in, when he got in the Republicans in the Senate when they were in the majority, and Clinton did not get such great support. George W. Bush got incredibly good support from his party, and what Obama wants to see is a Democratic Party that follows him lockstep, that doesn't disagree, that doesn't dissent." You know, using these very big majorities to pass the programs that Obama has promised to do or wants to do, and do it quickly. And you rightly point out, that's not in the Democratic Party's character or nature or recent history. So if change is going to happen, that's the kind of change that has to happen in the Democratic Party. They have to really, you know, I don't know if people get upset with me for this, they have to act more like Republicans in their legislative loyalty and their legislative unity.
We have 3-4 minutes left here. Another caller, someone in Decatur, line one. Hello.
Good morning. I've been thinking about something, and I'd just like to get your opinion on it. You know, we allow one vote, or one person, one vote, but we don't allow one person, one contribution. So that when you're running for, let's say, a county or a legislative district in Illinois or anywhere, why do we allow money from Texas or anywhere else in this country to influence that election? Shouldn't we be passing laws and saying, okay, look, one person, one vote, one person, one contribution, and that's it. You can't get money from anywhere else but from people. And that would make politics a little bit more local. I'd like to get your opinion on that. Thanks.
That, you know, that is a terrific question. I mean, that's worth a whole extra hour. I mean, there's no way I can do that in 2 minutes, but I'll be very quick to say I think you raise a really important question two ways. One is, what do you think representation is? What's your conception of representation? Is it local? In other words, should communities decide their own school system, their own political system, who they elect, and therefore the money should stay in the community and come from the community, and that representatives, even nationally elected, in other words, elected to national legislatures, they should really be bound to their local constituents and their local contributors. That's one view of representation. That's one version of it. And if you share that view, yes, you think that that contribution should really only come from that geographic area. But the other view is that financial contributions to campaigns are speech, right? This is what the Supreme Court says they are, although it's an ambiguous decision because they limit it. But they still say it's really tantamount to speech, and you can't limit speech, period. So this is the problem. What if I really support somebody who's in a different district, even, you know, within my own state, and I want to give money to that person and support that person's behavior? I'm not allowed. Under your program, I wouldn't be allowed. It would be a trade-off. And the American people haven't really thought enough of the issue or decided about it, or at least even been allowed to participate in that kind of decision-making, because that's the really big issue there. What kind of representation do you want? And if you want ideology or national party unity, then you want people to be able to contribute all over the country. If you really want representatives to pay attention to their own constituents and really think about their own communities, then you want to limit outside contributions.
All right. We'll try to do one more. Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hello. You touched on the subject of the lack of unity in the Democratic Party, which is something I was just discussing with somebody. And I think it's definitely a top down problem. Obama, I really respect his leadership, but I don't see how he's going to get anywhere with a majority leader like Harry Reid, who just yesterday said that Ted Stevens shouldn't go to jail because he's a war hero, and that he wasn't going to be a rubber stamp for Barack Obama. And this is a problem with the Democrats. He said recent history. It hasn't always been a problem, but it's very frustrating to people like us who still believe in the ideals of the Democratic Party to look at this abject cowardice and these sellout positions all the time. I'll take my answer up here. Thank you very much.
Well, I think here's the deal with Harry Reid. I think he was elected and served in the leadership when it was a very partisan era, and most of the time he served in the minority. So his style is very good for minority politics. In other words, if you're in the minority in the Senate and you want to obstruct and block and obstruct and block and critique, that's a really good style that he had. So the Senate Democrats elected him, and they kept, you know, reelected him and said, okay, you're our guy for that kind of style. In 2007 and 2008, he still had a Republican president, so he could still be an opposition leader. So in other words, they didn't see any real problems with his style. I think you're pointing out something very important. It's unclear that that kind of leadership style will translate and work well in the majority, especially a big majority with a Democratic president. So it may be that his leadership style for the minority side, being in the minority, is not well suited, not well adaptable to being a leader, a real leader for the Democratic Party and leading them in a cohesive, unified, and non-confrontational way. So what you may find is they won't jettison him in the next 2 years because that's just too much political controversy and it opens up the party to weaknesses. But I think there will be a lot of effort to moderate him and also maybe surround him with a few younger senators, people who are a little bit more television friendly, people who are a little bit more in terms of Obama's vein. I think that's what they're going to try to do. But you're pointing out a very important thing is that not everybody can do every job well. And so you can be a great minority leader or majority leader when you're facing an opposition president. But when it comes to carrying the president's program, program, you may not be as well suited.
I want to ask one last question. Unfortunately, I can't really give you more than about a minute, but it goes back to the point that we started, one of the things we started talking about. I guess I'm interested in whether you think that the change in the selection of the Senate from the state legislators doing it to a popular vote, was that a good thing or a bad thing, or it was just a change?
No, I think in the end of the day, if you want to say normatively for democracy, you have to say that when a system gets more open, when a process is opened up, in other words, when you take it out of the hands of anywhere from, 27 or 28 legislators in the Delaware state legislature during this time to, 250 in Pennsylvania, and you send it to the hands of thousands and if not millions of voters, you're better off in a democracy. It's going to be a more open, more competitive system. It won't be perfect. People won't be scrupulously honest every day of the week, but it will be, on the whole, better. And what we saw with responsiveness is that senators became slightly more responsive, and that grew over time as elections moved really to be much more public and much more participatory. They got a little more responsive to their constituents, and things are more transparent. And in the general population of the Senate, things got a little bit less corrupt. So I think in the end of the day, normally with democracy, it was a good thing.
All right. Well, there we'll have to finish. Having covered an awful lot of ground with our guest, Wendy Schiller, she is Associate Professor of Political Science and Public Policy at Brown University. And Professor Schiller, thank you very much.
Thank you.